Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Panorama Cafe. Caton was kind enough to invite me back, so I'm pleased to be back. We've given a few talks here before, and it's fun to share the light of the great and the good Thomas Jefferson in a friendly and warm audience. And it is a cafe, so please order dessert and make yourselves at home. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Eric Peterson, and I'm the editor of Thomas Jefferson's Light and Liberty. This is a book of inspirational writings that I pulled from Thomas Jefferson's vast collection of written legacy, letters primarily. And I put it together to try to present the essence of Thomas Jefferson's very uplifting personal life philosophy, and the philosophy that's at the heart of what Americans love about our country and what's inspired the world. Caton asked me to talk tonight about a book called The Jefferson Bible. Now, this is a title that posterity put on a work that Thomas Jefferson prepared for himself and for no one else's eyes. I mean, he knew posterity would be looking at it and thinking about it after he died, but during his own life, he prepared this material solely for his own edification and not even for his own family. He was a lifelong free thinker. He read everything he could get his hands on. In fact, his library reached 6,000 volumes at one point, and he sold it to Congress to reestablish the Library of Congress after the British burned Washington in 1814. Among his readings, of course, were readings of ancient Greece and Rome, readings of the Renaissance era thinkers and writers, the writers of the Enlightenment. And he didn't confine his readings in any particular field. He read everything that he could get his hands on, and he read it in as many languages as he could. And he was always intent on reading books in their original language. And he read seven languages. He spoke four. And among those that he read, of course, were Greek and Latin, which were foundational language studies of his time, and even right up through the 19th century into the early part of the century. Students, educated people in the United States were expected to read Greek and Latin to help them understand their own language better. So he read the Bible, of course, as part of his general readings, and he studied it very carefully throughout his whole life. He read it in Greek and Latin, as well as in English and French. And it was part of a self-study program that he had as he developed his own philosophy of life. He was very interested in having a philosophy that not only appealed to his mind as part of his intellectualism and his study of the Enlightenment ideals, but also something that appealed to his heart as well. He read the Bible a lot, personally, and much of his correspondence was about the Bible with different colleagues and friends that he had made through his years of public service. The Jefferson Bible, as it's called, he called it The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Bible in English, French, Latin, and Greek. It was a project that he started. It was essentially a cut-and-paste exercise in which he selected material from the Bible in those different languages and from the four Gospels. And he tried to compare what each of, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Fourth was saying. He thought, compared, contrasted, clipped, and he arranged what he thought was the actual words of Jesus and the simple facts of Jesus' life. And he started this project when he was president, corresponding with Joseph Priestley as one of his Enlightenment colleagues, if you will, in Philadelphia, a member of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, where he was president. And he started it in the early years of his presidency. And he also corresponded with a fellow named Benjamin Rush, and they were both active free-thinking intellectuals, Unitarians by religion, in Philadelphia, where he had spent a lot of the 1770s and, again, a lot of the 1790s. And he engaged them in philosophical discourse about the nature of religion, faith, spirituality, as one of his many interests in life. As we all know, he was interested in everything, a man of the Enlightenment and a great Renaissance thinker. And so he started this, and essentially this cut-and-paste project for his own study when he was president, and then he came back to it in later years. In 1819, I think, he began it again when he was 76 years old in his retirement, when he was working on the University of Virginia and planning the curriculum and so forth. He came back to this project, and it was essentially a scrapbook. This scrapbook was found in his vast collection of papers when he died 7 years later, and they were part of his legacy to his family and to the world. And it was discovered among his papers by his executor, his grandson, Jeff Randolph. Jefferson's papers were not published right away. They were published in small bits and pieces through the 1840s and 50s. The first major biographer of Jefferson was a fellow named Henry Randall, who published some of Jefferson's letters and correspondence. But the public did not really get a real full dose of Thomas Jefferson's writings until the 1890s, some 70 years after he died. And part of the effort to celebrate the reascendancy of his reputation, if you will, around the turn of the century, was the publication of this scrapbook. He called it A Wee Little Paradigm of Morals from Jesus. An effort was made to actually turn it into type, and it was printed around the year 1900. And it's been published in print off and on ever since. The Unitarians, which was it's one of the religious sects or denominations in the United States that actually claims Jefferson as an adherent. He once said, sooner or later, all the world will be Unitarian. I'm not sure he actually meant the Unitarian religion as much as, you know, belief in a single one God as opposed to Trinitarian, which was the prevailing belief at the time. It's been in print for about 100 years now. You can get one yourself. And different well-meaning and good-spirited organizations will publish it from time to time. I'm sure you can get this at Monticello. And in fact, the Unitarians keep this in print by the Beacon Press in Boston. It's very interesting to read Thomas Jefferson's take on the stories of Jesus' life in the Bible, and also the words that Thomas Jefferson selected from Jesus as presented in the four Gospels in the Bible. Because Mr. Jefferson, as we all know, was extremely private about his religious beliefs. He said that religion is a matter between man and his maker. And he thought that it was solely each individual's personal business, what they believed and what they read. He didn't want to have any government or even any organized religion telling people about their own beliefs. He thought it should be, beliefs should come from the heart, from a person's intuitive sense of what feels right as they look at life and they think about deeper matters of faith and spirituality and religion. And so when you study Thomas Jefferson, it's so fascinating because he never revealed his religion during his entire life. People had to guess at what he believed, and the guesswork was all over the place because he never said anything. People said, well, he must be a deist, or he must be a theist, or he must be an atheist, or one of those ists. And he just smiled and let people think what they thought. Whatever they wanted to think about his religion, that was fine. He said, what's important is a person's actions. It's their actions, not their words, in which their religion may be found. He said, the entire course of my life has been on the public stage, and people can judge my religion from my acts and my service to my fellow man. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the world in which Jefferson lived, his sense of morality, and his manifestation of his faith in his public life, and then come back to the Jefferson Bible itself and what that says about Thomas Jefferson's beliefs, which we're now privileged to see because he's passed on, but no one who was alive at the time, even his own family, was privileged to know what Thomas Jefferson actually believed in matters of faith. Thomas Jefferson was born only about 50 years after witches were put on trial, burned at the stake in Salem, Massachusetts. So that tells you the era that he was born in. And it tells you about the state of fear that pervaded so much of society, insecurity, uncertainty. And it tells you about people's willingness to make judgments about other people and their beliefs and actually punish people severely for having beliefs that were considered heretical. The Enlightenment had dawned during Jefferson's era. He was born in 1743. There was a lot of discussion in educated circles about the principles of the Enlightenment in France and in Scotland and England and so forth. Tolerance and respect, allowing the various religious sects to break away from the Catholic faith, which was the predominant faith in Europe for 1,500 years. In the United States, many of the states were formed on principles of religious freedom. Two in particular were the leaders. Rhode Island was founded by a great patriot named Roger Williams. And Roger Williams wanted to establish the first haven in the world for skeptics and heretics and believers and non-believers in people of any faith or no faith. And you can read his writings and you can see the foreshadowings of Thomas Jefferson's philosophy of not only religious toleration, but absolute religious freedom. Similarly, in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania was founded by a great idealist named William Penn, who wanted to found a utopia in the New World for freedom and prosperity. And again, if you read William Penn's writings, they're very much foreshadowing the principles of respect, oneness, toleration, and religious freedom, which so infused Thomas Jefferson's thinking. But on the other hand, there were a number of states that weren't so tolerant, and Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson grew up, was one of them. There was a state religion. It was the Anglican religion, and Virginia was the largest state of the colonies at the time. And anyone who was a little bit different was looked down upon. There wasn't overt persecution, but there was widespread intolerance. And if you weren't paying taxes to support the Anglican state church, or being willing to take oaths of office and so forth, support the established, it was a state religion, the Anglican religion, Episcopalian religion today, you were kind of marginalized. And so everyone had to acknowledge, at least in some respect, the primacy of the Anglican church. This always bothered Jefferson. It wasn't that he was non-religious or irreligious. He did attend church services occasionally. He did contribute to churches, building funds for various churches, Methodists, Baptists, and so forth, Presbyterians. But he was essentially non-denominational in his thinking. He was a man of faith who would occasionally attend church, and that was it. But what he didn't like was the state religion. He had studied history. As you've heard me say before, many of you, he was always talking about kings, priests, and nobles as the three institutional groupings of any society which seems to emerge over the course of time. Kings representing government, priests representing organized institutional religion, and nobles representing large moneyed interests. And he always thought that each one of these groupings of society would aid and abet the other in preserving their own power. And he particularly thought that the central power in organized religion was perhaps even a worse destructive force for humanity, at least up to his time, than centralized power in a government or a king. He was always railing against kingly government, and as we all know, advocating for a republican government, representative democracy of the people, and limiting centralized government power. But he was equally critical of centralized religious power. One of his most powerful expressions that I came across in reading his writings had to do with the abuses of the power of organized religion over the course of time. He said, millions of innocent men, women, and children since the introduction of Christianity have been burnt, tortured, fined, and imprisoned, and yet we have not advanced one inch toward uniformity. In other words, the impulse of organized religion and the powers and passions that it represents had created some of the worst abuses in the history of mankind, and particularly when tied with the power of civil government or kingly government. I mean, we all know the stories of all the excesses of the combined power, as he said, of altar and throne. And so it was against this backdrop that when he had the opportunity to write laws for the newly free state of Virginia after the revolution began, the independence year of 1776, he went back to Virginia where he thought the action was. You didn't have to pass the laws of the colony of Virginia past the king or the king's appointed governor anymore. The people passed the laws and that was it. So he had an opportunity to redo all the laws. And he rewrote educational laws, criminal laws, all sorts of things. One law that he wrote ended up being so important to him that he actually put it on his tombstone, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And that law, in essence, disestablished the Church of England as the official state religion of the state of Virginia. And it said, you can't compel a person to attend church. It said you can't tax people to support the state religion. It said every person shall be free, absolutely free, without constraint or coercion, to have their own religious beliefs or non-beliefs. And it was an eloquent statement against the coercive power of either organized religion or of civil government. And so he wrote this law. It was one of, believe it or not, 126 separate acts or new laws that he wrote for the consideration of the new Virginia state legislature. And many of them passed fairly quickly. His education bill, as you've heard me say before, never passed for 50 years. It was a bill for public education. This bill, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, did pass. It passed 9 years later in 1786. Mr. Jefferson was the minister to France in the middle of his 5-year term of service in France when it passed. And it passed under the vigorous advocacy of his great friend James Madison, who was the, as we all know, the father of the Constitution and a great friend of Jefferson's and a great similar advocate for religious liberty. Jefferson and Madison had worked on this from 1777 to when he actually left to be the Minister to France in 1784. That was 7 years, and it passed 2 years after he went to Paris. And part of that time, he was governor of Virginia. So he's working away in this legislature composed primarily of wealthy farmers and planters, landowners, slaveholders, the elite society of Virginia at the time, to try to pass this revolutionary document. There were hints of this in Pennsylvania and in Rhode Island, as I mentioned, but this was really the first time where we have a large expanse of territory that anyone purported to put forth an unequivocally bold statement of religious liberty and freedom. So with the great efforts of his friends in the state legislature, Mr. Henry, for example, opposed it bitterly, as well as a number of the leading figures in Virginia, it passed. Now, this was 1 year before the Constitutional Convention convened in Philadelphia in 1787. The example that this law afforded was right there in the life experience and the political experience of James Madison. So when Madison was working on drafts of the Constitution and later the Bill of Rights, Mr. Jefferson was in Paris, as I mentioned, sending forth letters about the new Constitution and saying that this Constitution needs a Bill of Rights, providing unequivocally for freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and so forth. And so this was really right at the heart of what Mr. Madison was all about, too. And so he carried the spirit of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom right into his work on the federal Constitution. This is one of our most treasured parts of our federal Constitution, which Mr. Jefferson called the primitive and precious model of what is to change the condition of man all over the globe. And of course, the First Amendment, the first article of the Bill of Rights, says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof." It's right there in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And it was really at the heart of Jefferson's work, life work. And he said at one point in his writings that he never fought a political battle that was more bitterly resisted by the opposition than his battle to pass the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. That's how hard it was to get this principle fundamentally written into law. And this was the first law that I always say, and I don't think it's true, this was the first law in the history of the world to provide unequivocally for absolute freedom of conscience over a large expanse of territory, and prohibiting any government, whether it's an autocratically constituted government or a democratically constituted government, whatever it is, the government's the ruler, however it got there, and prohibiting any ruler, any government, from restraining a person's religious faith. And this is one of the things he was most proud of, and as we all know, it's the third item on his tombstone that he wished to be remembered for. Here is buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence and of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, and father of the University of Virginia. Okay, so Mr. Jefferson does his life service, his political service, culminating with two terms as president, and retires to Virginia. There's a small college on the drawing boards in Virginia called the Central College for Virginia. And it was a local academy, basically, with not much going on there. So he took that little acorn of an idea and grew it into the great University of Virginia. It's all Jefferson's vision. When it came to setting forth a vision of, well, what about religion and the University of Virginia, he struggled with the question a lot because people expected there to be some kind of serious religious affiliation of the University of Virginia. And after all, Virginia was, even though their church had been disestablished, there was an awful lot of emphasis on organized religion. The various denominations were wanting to see religious education for the students of the university. They were wanting to see professor of divinity appointed for the University of Virginia, and really make it like all the other colleges in the country. Mr. Jefferson had gone to the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg. That was his alma mater. And that was a church that was heavily connected and partially sponsored by the Anglican Church. And even after the Revolution, there was still a tight religious affiliation with the Episcopalian Church of William and Mary. Harvard University maintained tight religious affiliations. Most of the universities did. And he said, no, 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 this is going to be a purely an educational institution. We don't need to have professors of divinity. People should study religion in their own lives with their own church affiliations, but not here at this public university. He did receive some opposition to that position, and he did bend a little bit when he wrote the curriculum. As you know, he was the father of the university, just like he put on his tombstone, his epitaph. And he planned the curriculum, and he went around, he hired and interviewed the professors, and acquired the library, the books that the students were to read, and so forth, and as well as being the architect of the university and the construction manager. And so when it came to what are the students going to study, he was a master. He put together all of his life experience. And if you read the list of the curriculum, it's a very powerful, modern list of every conceivable subject in the humanities and in the sciences. Very modern, very complete, but there's no indication there of religious studies or professors of divinity or anything like this. He thought that if you're going to study religion, you should study it through language or through philosophy or something like that, not as a direct core keystone element of the curriculum. And so this is what the public saw of Thomas Jefferson, the great champion of building a wall of separation between church and state, between organized religion and civil government. As you've heard me say before, he was really bitterly attacked as an atheist when he ran for president because people didn't know anything about his religion. He said, "Say nothing of my religion. It's between me and my conscience, between me and my maker." And yet, what the public did know about Jefferson was that he had a general sense of goodness, of goodwill toward his fellow citizen, a general faith in the obligation of service and the betterment of mankind. And if you look through all of his public pronouncements, you can see a generalized, let's say, spiritual faith in his writings. All men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with inherent and unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so right there you have a Creator giving rights that are beyond any government or any religious institution to control or to coerce or to force upon people. For the protection of these rights, we rely on the protection of divine providence. So clearly there's an expression of faith. It's not Catholic, Quaker, Jewish, Episcopalian. It's a generalized faith, and that's all it was. Then you look at his Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. He starts off, where does our religious freedom come from anyway? How can we claim this? Almighty God hath created the mind free and manifested his supreme will that free it shall remain by making it altogether insusceptible of restraint. So there is a Creator. The Creator created the human mind. It's intrinsically free. And if you attempt to coerce it or restrain it, he said it merely begets habits of hypocrisy and meanness and doesn't get you anywhere because the mind is intrinsically free and cannot be coerced. It can just be painfully repressed by public actions. The sense that there is a benign creator of this creation that has given human beings a mind which cannot be coerced or constrained was an absolute article of faith to Thomas Jefferson, and it was intrinsically the basis of his philosophy. And so you can read Jefferson's writings and see beautiful references to the creator, the one who doth no ill kind of thing, the author of our existence. He had wonderful way with words, and it was an elegance and an eloquence to his expression of his beautiful philosophy of life, all coming from his own heart. When people ask Mr. Jefferson, well, where did you get the wording and the ideas for the Declaration of Independence? And he said, well, we had no occasion to read old musty parchments. We looked within and we found them inscribed on the tablets of our hearts. This is the way he felt. He was a great student. He was a great intellectual. But he's also an intuitively attuned individual who is aware of more fundamental, deeper truths. He was really intent on bringing this kind of faith about what human existence is all about right smack into the middle of the public discourse and public interactions, public philosophy discussions, and ultimately laws and constitutions. If someone says, well, where does it say we have the right to free speech or freedom of the press or freedom of religion or freedom of conscience, why can't a new autocrat or a new body of elected people seek to restrain those basic rights? The answer to Jefferson was they're naturally given. He said, these rights, particularly freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, always the first freedom to Thomas Jefferson, were given by nature and the hand of nature and the God of nature. It's a wonderfully beautiful philosophy, which is expressed in broad, general, simple, pure, wholesome, humble terms, if you will. It's not encrusted by any theology, dogma, rituals, or anything like that. Just a basic human faith that there is a benign creator at the basis of everything, that creator has given us our freedom of conscience. And so when you think about it, it's a very interesting way of looking at the whole subject. He's saying, and the country obviously agreed at that time by approving the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, he's saying that if you are an atheist, if you're a non-believer, in the way that he thought everyone had the right to be a non-believer, that freedom was given to you by a benign creator, and that the laws and the institutions of society had to recognize. He said at one point, it does me no injury if my neighbor believes there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. So he's recognizing, let people believe what they want. And he felt that, we might say today, spiritual faith will flourish from the hearts of people if operating in an uncoerced and unrestrained public or political environment. I believe that of all the causes and subjects that he championed and that he was really interested in, I believe this issue of freedom of conscience, of religious liberty, was really at the very heart of what he was all about. And even today, I think that we here in this country, and I think our friends around the world, really do see the spirit of Jefferson alive here. The religious debate has many, many faces to it. It's gone through countless iterations over the decades since he was with us. But everyone recognizes the fundamental bedrock freedom in the United States of America is freedom of conscience. It was the most important freedom for Jefferson. It came right from his heart. It was hardest fought battle of all his public policy battles. That's the outer Jefferson. That was what he put forth as a warrior for the principles of freedom, for light and liberty that we all identify with him. Now, the inner Jefferson is a very interesting thing because, as I said before, you can't really get but some glimpses of it when you read his public writings for all these reasons that I've been talking about. So then you say, well, what did Mr. Jefferson really believe himself? And so every once in a while, you can get a glimmer of that in the correspondence that he had with his many friends. You can see a little bit more of it when it comes to this Jefferson Bible. So much of Mr. Jefferson, when you read him, is cast in terms of the language of the rational reasoning mind, the enlightened mind of the Enlightenment. As I said, he was extremely well read, so a lot of his correspondence that he had privately that was never revealed to the public involved discourses and debates back and forth between his very well-educated correspondents and friends. This correspondence will have discussions about Thucydides. We'll have discussions and correspondence about John Locke, Voltaire. You can name 100 enlightened, intellectual, well-read figures throughout history. Jefferson had read them all. He remembered what he read. He could have very intelligent dialogues about them, and so they're philosophical correspondences going back and forth, particularly with John Adams in the last 15 years of life. Very, very interesting. He's displaying a spiritual belief system, you might say, that reflects hard-headed scientific rationality and reason at the heart of the Enlightenment. And at the same time, it's displaying a softness of the heart and the intuitive, almost emotional feel, the inner feeling about what he thought his personal religion should be all about. And when I put light and liberty together, it just struck me that the most important thing about Mr. Jefferson, after all is said and done, was his faith. I chose faith as the first chapter in the Light and Liberty book. There's a chapter in there on Jesus because he had some beautiful thoughts about Jesus. And the book concludes with a chapter on peace, which is at the heart of the philosophy. In the chapter on faith, you can see a rational mind of the Enlightenment looking around and observing, look at an animal, look at a tree, look at an insect, and say, this creature is perfect in every respect, not only within itself, but in its relationships with all other creatures. Who can disagree that there has to be a cause and a fabricator of all this imperfection that we call life. There has to be an intelligent force behind all this. Ergo, there is a God. He also has wonderful heart things that are not provable from rational analysis, from the application of the intellect, expressions that are not physical in nature. For example, he'll observe that this creator, this beneficent creator, obviously felt that we were all destined to live together in society. How can that actually work? He really felt that the Supreme Being was very practical. How could that actually work unless each human being had within him or herself a compass, a sense of right and wrong, a moral conscience that would allow us all to live together peacefully in society, working together for our own happiness and also for the greater good. He often talks about the importance of a sense of identity with others. There's a section in the book called Oneness, and he says, we are all members of the universal society of mankind, and that every human being has an interest in the peace, happiness, and prosperity of every other. And so he's saying we all have intrinsic to our being a moral compass, a moral sense, a conscience to be our inner guide. And we don't have to rely on others, and particularly on priests. Again, he lived 250 years ago, and the rule of priests in the world was very, very powerful. And this really takes us to Jefferson's core view on what the Bible was all about. He regarded Jesus as a great moral teacher. And he said that the pure moral wisdom which fell from the lips of Jesus was the most sublime that had ever been offered to humanity. He said that Jesus was meek, benevolent, wise, and he pushed his scrutiny into the heart of man and purified his thoughts at the fountainhead. This is Jefferson talking about Jesus. And then he said, but what happened? He said that the purest, most benevolent, wisest moral teachings ever offered to humanity had been twisted and perverted by a self-interested group of people purporting to speak in Jesus' name, but actually more interested in their own power, position, and prestige than in actually advancing the teachings of Jesus. This was the Christian priesthood, which took these beautiful pronouncements and made up stories, fabrications, superstitions, rituals, dogma, and so forth, that the institutions of religion created in the name of Jesus were absolute perversions in the mind of Thomas Jefferson. This is particularly true when it came to conflict, because he said, no doctrines of Jesus lead to schism. Can you imagine that? In one line, he captured 1,500 years of history where people from the religion that was institutionalized in the name of Jesus would conduct wars against others, and the institution itself broke off into many parts of its own religion, and those parts conducted wars against each other, all in the name of Jesus' teachings. This is ridiculous. No doctrines of Jesus lead to schism. Part of the approach on the Jefferson Bible was to look at the Bible and the stories and the admonitions in it and say, is this really advancing the true religion, the religion I believe in, the moral teachings of Jesus of Nazareth? That was his religion. He said, I am a Christian in the only sense that he, meaning Jesus, ever wished anybody to be sincerely attached to his moral teachings above all others and believing sincerely that he never ascribed any divinity to himself. He didn't see Jesus as the Son of God. He professed not to see any divinity in the sense that the priests had taught about the divinity of Jesus, but he did refer to Jesus occasionally as the Savior. So you see that he's trying to get away from all of the ideas about who Jesus was and the institutions that were created in his name and go right to the actual words of Jesus, the moral teachings of Jesus, forgiveness being at the heart of Jesus' teachings. And he tried to get away from all the stories that he thought were not grounded in any kind of reality that he knew, any natural reality that he'd ever experienced, the supernatural miracles part of the story of Jesus. He didn't believe that there was a virgin birth. He didn't believe that there was a physical resurrection. and he didn't believe in the miracles attributed to Jesus because he said, I'd never seen anything like this. It defies my rational observations. But I really like what Jesus is trying to teach this world about how to live a better, more moral life for the good of mankind. This is what the Jefferson Bible demonstrates. He took his razor, as I said, he started the project in 1804 when he was president. He prepared what he called the syllabus of the philosophy of Jesus. He said it was a project of two or three nights only during February of 1804. And again, it was a scrapbook. He pasted it together. And he wrote to Mr. Priestley and Mr. Rush about it, and Mr. Adams a little bit later, but that was it. Just three or four people knew that he ever done this. And as I said before, when he was 76 years old in 1819, he went at it again and put a lot more effort into it this time. The Jefferson Bible itself is very short. It's only about 40 printed pages. And it's the simple facts of Jesus' life without the, what he called the superstitions, the fabrications, the things impossible about Jesus. And then using that simple narrative about the facts of Jesus' life, interspersing Jesus' moral teachings. And it's really a great thing to read because he encapsulates in 40 pages this beautiful philosophy of Jesus, philosophy that kind of reflected and guided his own thinking on how to live a good life and how to a personal belief system that made sense to him, both to his head and to his heart. I think that he ultimately understood that this material would become public and published after he died, just as all of his writings, his 20,000 letters and all of the work that he left behind. He knew they would be published. He was an inveterate record keeper, and he really thought that he had something to offer the world. And he didn't want to let it just go away and turn to dust. So he put a lot of effort into recording what he saw and what he thought. And that included this Jefferson Bible. And so now when you have today's society looking for the authentic roots of America, he knew that American society, world society, would be looking back over the years at the great founders. And he knew all the greats of the time. He really wanted to have his view of what happened and why it happened and the philosophy behind it preserved and recorded for other people to continue to go back to and study. Mr. Jefferson is perhaps even more than Mr. Lincoln, the most studied, the most analyzed, the most thought about and written about of the founders. And so there it is. This is what totally fascinates me about it. When he was talking about Jesus's teachings, he said that he, Jesus, had left behind mere fragments of a sublime life and moral philosophy, which if filled up in the spirit of the Creator, meaning Jesus, would be one of the most beautiful, sublime philosophies offered to mankind. And so if you look at these nuggets of wisdom from Jesus, encapsulated so beautifully in the Jefferson Bible, you can see that those are the acorns, those are the nuggets. So let me break it there, and I think I'd like to have some questions. Hopefully this stimulated some interest and some questions. Thank you for coming tonight. I appreciate your attention and knowledge.